It's the Bert Cohen Show. History never stops. People keep dreaming. People keep taking action to make those dreams happen. Sometimes, well, all the time, there is resistance to those dreams. And it takes a lot of effort sometimes to make things happen. Things that seem obvious, there is remarkable resistance. Generally, in American history, not always, there's money involved. Yes, there is. And back in the first Prohibition, the much shorter prohibition, the one against alcohol, there was a lot of money to be made by keeping alcohol illegal. The bootleggers made lots of money keeping it illegal. They did not want to make it legal again. Now, they were not the only interests involved, but that was part of it. Well, now, skipping ahead, oh, quite a few years, some 80 years or so, there is movement to end prohibition on cannabis, marijuana. The name marijuana, got slapped on it by those who were for making it illegal because it was a Mexican name. They used it, they in the U.S. Senate, the southern areas, the southwestern areas, used it to keep the Mexicans out, and making it illegal was a way to stop that immigration. Well, it's coming closer now. Two American states have legalized the use of recreational marijuana, and they're doing very well. It's cut down on crime, et cetera, et cetera. But the struggle goes on. There are struggles at the state level and at the federal level. And we're going to talk about where a lot of that resistance is coming from. Where is the money? Follow the money, as has been said before. Our guest today on the Bert Cohen Show, I'm very pleased to have Sarah Briner. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Sarah Briner is data analyst with the Center for Responsive Politics, and she's responsible for overseeing the center's data analysis and research collaborations. She previously worked as the center's lobbying and revolving door researcher. That's interesting stuff there. Prior to joining Open Secrets, Sarah was a doctoral student at Ohio State University, where she also taught undergrad political science courses in political behavior. Her dissertation was entitled Politicians Behaving Badly, The Determinants and Outcomes of Political Scandal in Post-Watergate America. Sounds like an interesting read. Open Secrets is part of the Center for Responsive Politics, which is the nation's premier research group tracking money in U.S. politics. Money in U.S. politics seems to be the problem for just about every issue, and also studies its effect on elections and public policy. Nonpartisan, independent, and nonprofit, the organization aims to create a more educated voter and an involved citizenry. Ooh, scary stuff. And a more transparent and responsive government. What a concept. And she wrote an article, the center wrote an article about the resistance to legalize marijuana. And part of that article says, whatever the health effects, the legalization of cannabis brings a formerly black market into the legal economy and gives rise to a new industry that spends money in Washington to further its interests. Now, that's on one side. Today, we're going to focus mainly, take a magnifying glass on the group spending money lobbying on both sides, for keeping it illegal and for making it legal. And as I said, Colorado and Washington have legalized marijuana, not just as a medicine, but for recreational purposes. Sarah, how do these state laws relate to federal law regarding recreational cannabis? And what about medical marijuana state laws? How does that jibe with federal laws?
Well, right now, the Obama administration has made it clear that they are, well, for now, that they're not going to be prosecuting anyone in the states where it has been legal, either for medicinal or for recreational purposes. So I think really the battle for legalization, either for medical or for recreational uses, is going to be at the state level. And as is the case with many things, once there's kind of a tipping point, there may be changes at the federal level, but I would imagine that it's going to be a ways off, that more states are going to need to move in that direction before the federal government would sort of change any of their major policies.
Well, but what are the federal laws? I mean, a lot, here in New Hampshire, when the issue was being discussed, part of the opposition, what really stopped it from happening was, well, federal law, we'd be breaking federal law if we even legalized medical marijuana. Now, this is before the Obama policy change. But what federal law kind of supersedes the state laws and enables the states to say, oh, we can't do anything because of federal law?
Well, it's a class, it's a controlled substance. So much the same that cocaine or heroin is classified by the federal government as an illegal substance. Marijuana is in that same category. I think as the U.S. has a long history of respecting states' rights, I think that, and popular opinion is sort of in the camp of the pro-legalization movement right now, I think that the government would need to be sort of proactive in enforcing that law, and at least for now, they have not been so.
But have there been arrests, say, since the war on marijuana really ramped up in 1970, have all the prosecutions for possession, for possession of marijuana, have they all been at the state level? Has there been no prosecution coming down from federal agencies at all?
I would think that there, I would almost be certain that there had been. I don't know, but I would be shocked if the federal government wasn't enforcing aspects of that law in states where it's illegal. Certainly fighting sort of the importing and the sort of drug trade,
right,
is something that the Drug Enforcement Agency has made a huge priority, and that includes marijuana, even though I think policy-wise people treat it as a, you know, it's not in the same class, even though it is technically in the same class, it's not in the same class as something like cocaine.
And I believe, am I correct here that it is really technically in the same class by law as heroin and cocaine? Is that right?
That's right.
That's nuts. We are talking with Sarah Briner, data analyst with the Center for Responsive Politics. Now, there's obviously a great deal of money in this and, well, virtually every other issue that comes before Washington. And you guys, the Center for Responsive Politics, you just focus on Washington, correct?
That's correct.
And so I'm curious about, in Washington, you know, you have your usual one side of the aisle versus the other side of the aisle. It's been a tremendous amount of battles and gridlock between liberals and conservatives in recent years. It seems to me this issue is a bit different. It doesn't seem to break down in the usual liberal-conservative blocks. What can you tell us about Democrats and Republicans in Washington on this, and what might their arguments be?
Sure. The major both funder of pro-legalization initiatives and then also sort of Washington-based advocacy group is called the Marijuana Policy Project.
Right.
And they're a nonprofit, technically, but they do donate to federal candidates, and they've supported Democrats and Republicans, but mostly Democrats. So there are a few exceptions, and I think that, and certainly there are Democrats that are opposed to legalization, I mean, including Dianne Feinstein and currently the White House. So, you know, it's not as clear a cut an issue as many other things, but I think it does have a sort of, the issue generally is more associated with Democrats.
Well, what
and the sort of big money sort of bears that out.
Well, there is, of course, these days, well into the 21st century, a very large and seemingly growing libertarian streak within the Republican Party. I don't know. This show is coming from New Hampshire, where, you know, if you don't run into a presidential candidate, you got to be hiding under a rock. But a lot of them, I would guess that people like Rand Paul probably are in favor of legalization from the point of view of being libertarian. You know, live free or die is the New Hampshire state motto. And are there? I would imagine the Republicans might be kind of split on this. And you know, the definition of conservative, what the heck does that mean when it comes to this issue?
Right. I think this issue sort of does tap at that almost culture war within the Republican Party. When I was researching for this, I looked, there's a group in California called Save Our Society.
Yes.
And they're also a nonprofit fund, but they, on their board, the chair of their board is a woman who was married to Mitt Romney's sort of Florida fundraising chair, and they own a drug treatment facility. So there's some sort of mixed influence there.
Mm-hmm.
But that just goes to show that, you know, at least in the case of sort of that part of the Republican Party, the legalization movement probably doesn't have much traction. But I think among younger and perhaps less regulatory-focused Republicans,
mm-hmm.
I think that the issue is either not a concern or something that they think it may be just unnecessary. So that would be my guess. I know that the Marijuana Policy Project has supported, the candidates that they've supported are exactly the kind that you're talking about, like Justin Amash from Michigan, who is certainly on the libertarian side of the Republican spectrum. And then Dana Rohrabacher from California has, brought forth some laws to, he calls it respecting states' rights sort of laws, but they would prohibit or restrict the federal government's ability to arrest people in California. So I think that this is an issue that's evolving. Younger Americans tend to be more in support of legalizing or at least decriminalizing marijuana. And as politicians, the sort of old guard, leave office, I would expect that support will grow. And you mentioned Rand Paul. He also received money from the Marijuana Policy Project, so that would seem to support that claim that he's pro-legalization.
Interesting. Yeah, and it does seem, you know, it is still a federal issue, and an old friend, Barney Frank, when he was in Congress, I don't remember his exact bill, but he tried to address the federal laws on marijuana, and I think he worked with Republicans on that. Do you recall, Sarah? I don't.
Oh. But one of the, I think both sides are clamoring for the mantle of bipartisan support. This is an issue, really, I think, when it comes down to it, of a challenge, like you said in the beginning, a challenge to the status quo. And the status quo right now is that this has been something that has been illegal for a long time, and there are vested interests. It would not be something that politicians in the past would really get much out of opposing because, where's the popular movement? Where's the broad-based support? But recently, as that's changed, as there have been state-level victories, I think the national politicians have started to evolve on the topic, as they probably describe it.
And there's so much misinformation or even intentional disinformation out there. It's really amazing. And, you know, one thinks about, the classic reefer madness, you know, that talked about people becoming insane and just doing horrible things and losing any sense of morals or ethics. Of course, that's long gone. I read something that there's something called the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Now, they say that marijuana, cannabis can negatively affect your brain, lungs, heart, and mental health. I haven't heard that posited anywhere. But them, who is the National Institute on Drug Abuse?
I've never heard of that. I do know that the American Medical Association, which is the, the largest
sure.
trade association for the health industry, and doctor group, really, they oppose legalization, but recently they said they still oppose it, but they want more research done. So, which is a slight evolution for them on that topic. And I think that that's kind of, I guess, the what you might call the state of the art for the health community. So if they're saying that more research is necessary, then I think that's a signal that some of the claims that people hear on both sides, really, but may not actually have scientific merit.
Not having scientific merit. Boy, that could be applied to an awful lot of issues that are being discussed.
That's true.
Oh, my goodness. Science? What's that? You know, if you're a 21st century Republican, you don't want to hear about science. And the idea of research, that's a very big thing that, I mean, for example, a lot of people in the psychiatric world would like to be able to research the use of LSD as a possible legitimate tool for helping people, you know, psychiatrically, and they have not been able to. I wonder what kind of research has been stopped so far by federal law, and what kind of research the American Medical Association, what would they like to research? We know, for example, that, you know, young people's brains are still developing, and they should not have access to marijuana. They should be kept away. It's in their interest to do so. But what kind of other research hasn't been allowed, and does the AMA want to be allowed?
That's a good question. I actually don't. I don't know what's being pursued in the medical community, but there's always a conversation between the medical community and the regulatory community, the scientific community and the regulatory community.
Uh-huh.
With alcohol, it's a legal substance, but it's restricted. And those restrictions were born of both research into its effects on the human brain and body and liver and health, and then also also its effects on society when people consume too much of it, but then also policymakers who are interested in public opinion, the industry that's involved with alcohol production, and their own understanding of the science that's presented to them. And I think that a lot of medical research is allowed on a variety of things that might shock people, so long as it's done through the auspices of, ethically sound and such. So I think that their statement about wanting more research is just that they don't think that the research that has been done is definitive enough for them to say anything one way or the other.
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of questions, especially with the potency of today's marijuana as compared to 40, 45 years ago. It's quite different. And, you know, people, when they get it now, you know, illegally, who knows what they're getting? Who knows what the strength of the various chemicals are? And, you know, if it's going to be legal, there has to be, I mean, like alcohol, some regulatory structure in place to, and hopefully people could find out, you know, how much THC and the other chemicals is there in this. And it's also true that there's, I don't know exactly what this is, but medically helping young kids with seizures, they've tried all different kinds of drugs, and there's been a melting down somehow, taking some component of the marijuana, and it helps them tremendously, helps neurological development in ways nothing else has. So that's probably one kind of research that they'd like to do, and I'd certainly like to see them do. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today, Sarah Briner, who is data analyst with the Center for Responsive Politics, kind of looking at Washington, looking at the use of money in Washington, the power of money. Well, as Bob Dylan sang so long ago, money doesn't talk, it swears. It has an awful lot of power. Well, let's look at who the biggest opponents, the strongest opponents of ending prohibition are. The most obvious guess would be its potential competition. The booze industry, the liquor, and the beer industry. What do we know about their efforts? Do they see a potential competitor in marijuana? What's their position on this? Are they, you know, that's sort of a guess as to who would be opposed. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, we did some writing about this, and based on data, and they reached out to us and said that at least the sort of National Trade Association for Alcohol and Beer and those groups reached out and said, no, we're not opposed to, we have no opinion, we have no position on legalization. But if you look at the data at the state level, state chapters of various beer and alcohol and liquor-associated organizations did give money to the No on Prop 19 groups. And so that's sort of an indication that even if the national group doesn't have a position, which they definitely said that they didn't to us, then the local chapters may be opposed.
It sounds a little.
I mean, you just like you said, you have to follow the money. And in California, there was the main monetary opposition, at least, came from public sector unions, including sort of police, sheriff, prison guards, and beer interests.
Well, interesting. Let's look at the police interest, the law enforcement interest. I mean, let's face it, it's real easy. You know, instead of fighting violent crime, it's awfully easy to bust somebody with a joint. There's the association of officers, the unions, and the chief's association. How much have they become, dare I say, dependent or addicted to drug war financial support?
I mean, the number of people in jail for marijuana crimes is very high, but I don't know. I wouldn't feel comfortable speculating about why any given law enforcement officer or group opposes legalization. It could be because, I mean, as is the case with almost any issue, there's also an ideological argument here. Like, it is not new for drug opponents, like Coalition for Drug Free America, you know, those sorts of groups to oppose drugs because they think that they're bad for people. And so that could very well be the case with police officers who may see effects of the drug trade and drug war and drug use that, like you and I might not see. So I don't think that it's necessarily a case of we want more people in prison, although it could be. I think that it could be more complicated than that.
Well, what about the drug wars? A tremendous amount of money has been spent in the drug war since it all really ramped up under Nixon in 1970. And a lot of that money, probably virtually all of it, goes in grants to state and local police departments. Don't they kind of depend on that? I mean, if that money isn't coming in, you know, isn't that kind of a problem for them?
Well, that is a, it could be.
Okay, well, I'm just looking at some statistics here. There are between 2001 and 2010, according to the ACLU, there were over 8 million marijuana arrests. 88% were for simple possession. Over half the drug arrests in the U.S. are for marijuana possession. One marijuana arrest every 37 seconds, and states spending combined over $3.6 billion in enforcing simple marijuana possession laws. And again, you know, following the money, it seems like there's an awful lot of money involved here. The state and local police spend a lot of money and also get money from the federal government in the drug war. And so it's unclear to me as to, you know, how much money the state and local police have become dependent on when it comes to, you know, fighting against the evil weed.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, I think that this is one of those cases where it's unlikely that you're going to get a police department or a sheriff's union to say, we want to keep marijuana illegal because it will give us jobs. But if you look at the data and you look at their political support in California and you look at the dependence on or how much of their activity is based on that kind of work and that kind of policing. I think it's up to the, the citizen to really draw those conclusions based on research.
And citizen power. It's frustrating how often people feel like they don't have power, but they do. We do. The people really do have a lot of power. The other obvious group is the private prison corporations. Tell us about them. How much of a power are they in Washington? That's kind of a relatively new movement, privatizing prisons.
Yes, they are a major power, not necessarily on this issue, and they're another group that reached out to us and said that they don't have an official position, but they have, again, a local affiliate did donate to the Proposition 19 opposition movement several years ago. But in D.C. generally, they're a new presence and they're a major presence, particularly for members who represent states like Arizona, where the industry is huge. I think that it's just one of those places where it's kind of a new actor. And so the federal government is in the process of figuring out how do we regulate these things? How do we sort of deal with the inherent conflict of interest of profiting on criminal activity. And so those questions are ones that are being worked out by both the public and by elected officials. And so in the process, the industry itself is trying to increase their profile and to make sure that when those decisions are made, they have a seat at the table.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, they obviously have a pecuniary interest in keeping marijuana illegal. It's so easy to arrest people for marijuana possession. It helps fill up the prisons, and they're all about profiting. They're not nonprofit. They are profit. They need to fill up their prisons.
Right. I mean, I think there's a ton of ethical questions about how a company can profit from illegal activity. And as the federal government and state governments experience revenue declines and have issues paying for their own systems, this industry has cropped up as an alternative. It's cheaper, alternative, at least to the taxpayer. But, I mean, I think that there are serious ethical questions about whether or not that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And since those questions are still out there, since they're still being discussed, everyone wants to make sure that their voice is heard, and the industry is no exception.
And as with so many issues, there's two sides, and oftentimes they struggle mightily against one another. An awful lot of money is involved here, and of course, politicians in Washington depend on campaign money, and that can swing an awful lot of not just elections but policy. You know, who gets elected, who gives, there's these quid pro quos that are, wink wink, they're not directly buying influence, but they're indirectly buying influence. I'm sure you see a little bit of that going on in your research. What about are there unions of prison guards? Do they have much sway on this?
They were also involved in the opposition to Proposition 19 in California, and I actually don't know at the federal level if there's sort of an official position that they have. But again, in that case, there could be a lot of reasons. I mean, doctors, the American Medical Association does not have as clear a monetary relationship to legalization as does the private prison industry, perhaps, or alcohol industry. And in the case of police officers and police unions and sheriffs and things like that, I think that there are certainly ideological questions, although there is also that sort of monetary relationship as well. It could be a bunch of, it could be, and it is, I'm sure, many different factors of influence going on.
Yeah, for sure. As with any issue, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. Some of it is altruistic, whether it's right or wrong is, who knows, but there's also a lot of money involved. Now, many who favor an end to prohibition have assumed that among the fiercest opponents to ending prohibition have been the pharmaceutical industry. How accurate is that? Is that just sort of a guess, you know, an easy target? Or tell us what you know, Sarah, about the pharmaceutical industry and ending prohibition on cannabis.
There was a report in 2012 that where somebody who lobbies for the anti-drug, somebody who lobbies for the anti-drug war groups told this report that one of the biggest opponents to legalization was the Pharmaceutical Trade Association. But they're another one of those organizations, so it's hard to get, there's no incentive, they don't have to clarify positions to the public about their opinions. And there are certainly are logical reasons why the pharmaceutical industry could be opposed to legalization, but then on the other hand, you know, the legalization of marijuana could result in an increased number of pharmaceutical products that use that drug. So there's sort of two things going on. They could gain, and they could also be sort of at a loss. If this was legalized. But I think the common understanding is that they're opposed.
And I know, for example, here in New Hampshire, where the show is coming from, there was, in terms of medical marijuana, there were a number of people who came up to testify, and one particular person who I shall never forget, who had an awful form of cancer, and it cost him $1,500 a month for his legal pharmaceuticals, and it made him sick. And he felt that he could get the same relief for $50 worth of marijuana a month, and it didn't affect his digestive system adversely. So it seems like you know, there's a lot of money to be made by the pharmaceuticals in this. And I imagine, yeah, they could be looking at money as well. And before we get to who could make money from, you know, legal marijuana, what about the drug cartels themselves? I understand in California with Prop 19 that a very large portion of the money spent opposing legalization from those now profiting directly from it being illegal, the growers and, you know, black market distributors. What about the drug cartels? You know, I'm sure they don't, you know, register as drug cartel lobbyists, but how might they be influencing Washington?
I actually don't know, because, like you said, they wouldn't be registering as any kind of entity. Politicians certainly are not, would never express any level of concern about the poor drug cartels. but, you know, these are influential in some parts of the country and in some other countries. And so, sure, legalization could have effects to them, but I think both at the national and state level, it's kind of a political non-starter because you don't, there would never be a situation where a politician would have any interest in taking concern for the drug cartel.
Well, though, is it not accurate that with Prop 19 in California that a great deal of money was spent by, I mean, just as individuals, I suppose, but it's fairly widely understood, it could be wrong, could be misinformation, that, you know, members of the drug cartels were, you know, helping to pay for TV ads against it and mailings and things like that.
I was looking at the money for that proposition, and I didn't see that. But I don't. This isn't my expert area of expertise. And so, if you're seeing like a name of somebody, and I'm sure there's been reporting on this, and somebody's doing more investigative research in depth about the money going to these campaigns, then that very well could be the case. I just don't wouldn't recognize from some of the list of donors. I know for the biggest group type of group that opposed legalization, as according to followthemoney.org, which is kind of the state-level affiliate of, not affiliate, but state-level equivalent to my organization, the biggest supporter for the anti-legalization effort was the public sector unions, so police officers and sheriffs and prison guards. So But again, you know, you don't disclose if you're a ballot measure or a campaign. You don't disclose, you know, drug cartel interest on your contribution form, because that would be probably not a winning situation.
Well, now that we can have these 527s and, you know, the Citizens United that just opened up the entire thing, people can do all this independent expenditures and, mm-hmm. you know, not give directly to campaigns of, you know, politicians, but just, you know, spend money on it because it's in their interest. All right. I got to ask, Patrick Kennedy made his presence felt in New Hampshire, and he's been going around. Maybe he misses the limelight. I don't know. But he created something called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. What do we know about them? My guess is that a lot of the drug counseling groups want to keep it illegal, and they have, you know, because they want to stay in business, basically. Right. What do we know about Patrick Kennedy's new group, which seems to have a great deal of money?
Yes. So you're right about the drug counseling group. There is a clear, like I said, I think Colorado, one of the major funders of the anti-legalization movement was a nonprofit where there's clearly an interest from a Floridian business owner who owns a drug counseling clinic. So that's kind of on record as being something that has happened in the past. This group, this Sensible Approaches to Marijuana, the Patrick Kennedy Associated Group, was actually, it's hard to figure out exactly what it is. I had a few people look into this. It doesn't say it's a nonprofit. It's not a registered political action committee. It looks as though it might just be an arm of a for-profit consulting firm. Which would explain the money.
Uh-huh.
And this for-profit consulting firm is managed by a guy named David Sabat, who is I think I've seen him reported as a neo-prohibitionist. He's a doctor from Florida who is a very actively opposed to legalization efforts and runs a drug consulting sort of drug counseling. He's in psychiatry and does work on in that area. So I don't, you know, with companies and with nonprofits, it's almost impossible, well, it can be very impossible to figure out kind of the ultimate source of the money. And this is the case where we just, I can't figure out what it is, and so it's hard to tell where the money's coming from. But it is interesting, and they have made, I think they're trying to be seen as very credible, because they have both ex-member of Congress Kennedy and then also David Frum, who used to work in the Bush administration, on their board of directors, and so that's kind of bringing a level of credibility to the organization, I think. And it is a new actor in this movement, I think, one that's responding to these new ballot initiatives that have been successful, and then kind of the changing tide of public opinion.
Well, it is curious as to what is behind this Patrick Kennedy thing. I mean, it seems, frankly, impossible that it could be merely altruistic. Again, you know, the speculation is that, I mean, drug counselors depend on drugs being illegal. The addictive drugs, you know, there's money to be made by counseling there, and that's fine. You need professionals to help people get off of addictive drugs, but it just, something doesn't smell right about this Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And I note that the, you know, talk about ramping it up. The New York Times has done a series of editorials urging full legalization of marijuana. And that's got to be, I would think, upsetting the other side, because they're pretty credible. You know, they have a big national presence, no doubt about it. And again, they have a great deal of credibility. Have you heard, Sarah, any reactions to the New York Times series of editorials on this?
I haven't heard any reactions to them, but I can think that that would be sort of the beginning or an early point in the, as I sort of mentioned, the evolution of politicians' opinions about the topic. And so I think we'll see in the next 5 years, in the next 2 years, an increasing number of high-profile individuals from both sides of the aisle who come out and say that they are at least, I think, pro-legalization is the farthest, like, is the
right
place to get people to. I think at least decriminalization of marijuana. And the Obama administration's sort of hands-off approach to marijuana in California, Colorado, and Washington is, I think, kind of another major, you know, it doesn't seem like much, perhaps, but it could be, that could have been a very different situation if they had come out swinging against the states. And there are a variety of reasons that it's not in their interest to do that, including being seen as anti-states' rights. But I think it also shows kind of the evolution of politics. I mean, I think it's been, I can't remember, I heard a statistic or a fact that the last at least three, maybe more presidents have gone on record saying that they've used drugs and have smoked marijuana. So I think that that's kind of another step in the direction of making this more legal.
The culture war, they can't stand it. And, you know, if Obama said he was for oxygen, you know, Republicans would come out against oxygen, you know, let's face it here. And I noticed that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, they can't take a position on it. They're the enforcers. However, I discovered that two former DEA officials came out recently urging the federal government to nullify new state marijuana laws in Washington, Colorado. But they're also facing criticism because they're running a company that may profit directly from keeping marijuana illegal. I speak of Robert DuPont, who was drug czar under Presidents Nixon and Ford, and Peter Benzinger, I hope I pronounced that right, who was administrator of the DEA in the 70s, today runs something called Benzinger DuPont and Associates, a company that specializes, get this, in workforce drug testing, among other employees' programs. They're opposed to legalizing marijuana because they make money from this. And their clients, where they have drug testing, where they make money from drug testing, include Kraft Foods, American Airlines, Johnson & Johnson, the Federal Aviation Administration, even the Justice Department itself. And I think that's interesting that they're asking Eric Holder to pursue prohibition policies that line their own pockets. What do you know about Benzinger, DuPont, and Associates? Are they new players on the scene as well?
I actually don't know about them at all. And I had heard that about the DEA ex-officials advocating against the new laws, but I don't know. I haven't tracked that money. But, you know, Kraft, American Airlines, the ones that you list, at least, are huge political actors in Washington. And so there are, you know, hundreds of politicians who have risked and have vested interests in that kind of company.
And for these guys to so blatantly come out against, you know, for cracking down on states that legalize marijuana, when they line their own pockets from drug testing contracts, I just, that's amazing how they can get away with that. I don't know. I guess it's money. Same old, same old. What about the trial lawyers? They vary quite a bit. They're usually fairly liberal, but what about trial lawyers? Have they taken a position on this? Do you know?
Not that I've seen. I didn't see anything about that. And again, these national organizations of that kind, pharma, alcohol, prisons, they're all very hesitant to take positions either way. You know, they might have members who support legalization or oppose it, but as a sort of collective entity, they have no interest in coming out publicly with their positions. And so I just don't know in this case.
Again, if you're listening to us now, Bert Cohen here. Our guest is Sarah Briner of Center for Responsive Politics. We're talking about the fight for and against legalization of marijuana, which really should be called ending prohibition, which has not worked. And I did note that, just reviewing some of my notes here, law enforcement agencies around the country get about $11 billion in taxpayer money for marijuana prohibition. That's according to Harvard economics professor Jeff Myron. $11 billion they would lose when prohibition ends. Now, as you know from watching Washington, members of Congress always need, they have to see that it's safe for them to come out on any issue. It's exceedingly rare that they're going to take a lead and take a risk about getting reelected. They need to know, they need to see that it's safe for them on an issue. In your observation, are members of Congress sensing much of a change in public opinion? Is it, I mean, you know, I know that most polls show that there's a fairly rapid shift, maybe not quite as fast as, you know, marriage equality, but a pretty rapid shift. Do you sense that politicians, members of Congress, are less scared to talk about this because of the fairly consistent polling?
I have no doubt. I think it was only in 2013 that there was polling showing that a majority of Americans supported, I can't remember if it was legalization or decriminalization, but one of those. And I think that that will almost certainly only continue to grow into wider and wider margins. And politicians, unlike justices and unlike industries, have to be responsive to public opinion or else they will lose their jobs. And you know, this is the broad swath of the American public, not necessarily people in specific regions. So I'm sure that this is regional. I'm sure that it varies based on age and as sort of as the people who are young now grow older and are replaced by even younger people, if that makes sense. I would think that the current sort of 20 and 30 year old American generation is probably one of the more pro legalization groups, and soon they'll be, you know, in their 40s and 50s and among the more active political actors. And so I think that this is just an evolution that's going to result in this being an issue, this being something just like alcohol.
And I had a question from a listener. He wanted to talk about any observable connection or speculative connection, really, between drug law enforcement on one hand and abusive police tactics such as SWAT raids. Do you have any sense about that? You know, there's a lot more concern these days since the, outrage in Ferguson about, abusive police and excessive enforcement. So the connect, and people of all stripes, all political stripes, are really concerned about, excessive use of force by police. So how much of a part do you think, you know, in terms of, this is public opinion still, enforcement of drug laws, how much of a part does that play in some of the, you know, abusive police tactics that we've seen?
Well, I don't know, but I, you know, in the case of this situation that's happening in Ferguson, I know that I saw at least briefly, although I think that this has been, sort of disappeared from the news as it's become more transparent, but I saw at least recently that they were saying that Michael Brown did have marijuana in his system, and I think the reaction to that was, and that I think is a signal that opinion on the issue is changing. But it does point to a conflict, again, between entrenched interests, so those who have been dealing with this issue for a long time in the form of law enforcing laws, and interests of the public. And that's always going to be a tension.
Mm. Yeah, they've been doing it for a while, and, you know, breaking into homes, the SWAT raids, that's some tough stuff. That's a very, you know, the militarization of police, I would think, has a lot to do with the ongoing drug war and the fact that they, you know, there's been no signs that they're winning the drug war. It seems that that can have the result of, you know, more weapons, more aggressive tactics. If you're not winning, you fight harder, you come in harder. So, you know, there is, I think, more and more concern about that going on. What about the moralist argument that recreational marijuana use contributes to the decline of our culture? Just from a practical, realpolitik vantage point, does this view hold much water in Washington? And if so, with whom? Might it be I suppose, the old Confederacy of the Southern states where, you know, they have their side of the culture war. But what about this moralist argument? Does that hold much water, or is it losing steam, shall we say?
It's probably losing steam, but it's certainly an important factor. You know, this is an issue where there's an ideological component, and people, you know, are opposed to drugs. People are opposed to alcohol. People are opposed to lots of things. And I think the sort of focus on the family type groups, and they did also fund some of these no legalization invalid initiatives, are a force to be reckoned with because they have a lot of power, they have a lot of membership, and it's just a belief that I think is shared by a lot of people who hold public office. And that's fine. That's a legitimate
sure.
a legitimate group of people, and everyone's entitled to their opinion. I think it probably is going to be the bigger, you know, in many cases, money is the only thing that matters. And just based on what I've sort of seen, I actually think that in this case, it's really more of a culture war kind of issue. I just think that the tide is moving in a direction where we're going to see changes as opposed to the status quo.
It does kind of seem that way. I frankly would have thought, having gone to college in the early 70s, I would have thought, oh, by 1980 it would have been legal. Boy, was I wrong. The states, that's where the battlegrounds are. I mean, two states have legalized it, seems to be going pretty well, and there's a tremendous potential for desperately needed revenue. I wonder what you're seeing of this. You know, the feds could make money, too. The feds could impose a tax as well. And I wonder about the pressure from states that are in desperate need of money. You know, many are, you know, reluctant to put big gambling casinos in there, but, you know, there's a lot of revenue coming in. I wonder how that need for revenue and having, shall we say, a pot of gold right there, I wonder how that will affect the discussion in the next couple of 3 years.
It will be interesting to see. I don't have any speculations.
Well, you do interesting work there at the Center for Responsive Politics. That phrase, responsive politics, what a concept. It's if people are interested in checking out the work you do, either with Open Secrets, well, what's the relationship between Open Secrets and Center for Responsive Politics?
OpenSecrets.org is just our public-facing website. So it's kind of, most of what I do involves the website, but it's just that's what the relationship is. That's just the name. CenterForResponsivePolitics.org would be kind of a long thing to put in the URL. So,
but people can go there to check out what you do if they're concerned about, you know, politics serving the common good, things like that.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. Been very, very interesting today, and the issue will go on, and probably if we come back in a couple of years, I can't help but think there'll be at least twice the number of states now. Who knows? It may happen quickly. We shall see. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Always love to hear from you. Bert@BertCohen.com. Thanks so much for listening.
Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it. Some call it
Tampa. Some call it the weed. players of instrument too. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. That's the best thing you can do. Don't criticize it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. And I will advertise it. It's good for the food. Good for us. Don't criticize.